Hi, and welcome to Do La La, the podcast.
With me, Leanne from Birthhood, and Meg from Birth Evolution. We are both birth and postnatal doulas with over 12 years' experience supporting people through pregnancy, birth, and the postnatal period.
In this podcast, we'll be taking a deep dive into birth in a relaxed and informal space, bringing you knowledge, experience, and tips in a way that supports you, whether you are pregnant, working in the birth world, or just a birth nerd like us.
We'll be leaving no stone unturned with our unfiltered approach to conversation about birth and can't wait for you to join us.
All opinions are, of course, our own, and our experiences and discussions in no way constitute medical advice.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of the Do La La podcast. I am Meg from Birth Evolution.
And I'm Leanne from Birthhood. Welcome, welcome.
Yay, so lovely to have you here. We are talking about something really important today, something that has become so much more of a consideration than it ever has been. Even when me and Leanne, I think when we were first having babies, so our eldest are nine,
yep,
this was not as big a thing at all. So we should maybe do a little pause of, can anybody guess what we're about to talk about? But they've already seen the introduction to the episode, so that doesn't quite work. We're talking about induction, something that I would eat my hat if you haven't had mentioned in some form of appointment by the time you have reached 39 weeks.
I mean,
depending on your circumstances and your characteristics.
A lot of my clients have had things pulled up. My client at the moment, she's 25 weeks, already had that conversation.
Oh, don't get me wrong, with certain characteristics, yeah, it'll be that booking in.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
So this is going to be a really general episode about induction. What we won't do is go into really in-depth detail about each of the forms of induction. We'll cover those briefly, but we want this to be a bit of a information session for people who just want to know about what it is, why might I be offered it, and looking at the stats, let's just accept it's the rates of it have gone up massively, maybe thinking about why that might be, and then thinking about the benefits and risks so people can start to think about those choices. But Leanne, can you just really clearly define what an induction actually is?
Yeah, so induction of labor is basically artificially starting labor at some point in the pregnancy. Different modes, different means, it can all happen and be used, but and you can use those processes to augment your labor at some point as well. But the main form of a reason of why induction is offered is to bring labor on, to start labor. Yeah. So it's obviously completely different to spontaneous labor.
Yeah. So it's basically choosing a point at which the pregnancy is going to be ended and to bring on a birth.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Okay. So it doesn't necessarily just happen in one procedure, that depending on your trust, there's lots of ways this can happen.
Yeah.
I talk about it as a ladder. What would you talk about it as?
Yeah, very much. I think people have an idea that I would say it's also a ladder. A lot of people think it's kind of a linear path.
Yeah, start it and then you're done and then it's
done. Yeah, as soon as you're on that conveyor. Yeah, that
like conveyor belt. Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas, I would talk about it. It's like a step-by-step approach and you can miss a step or whatever. So, I think a ladder's a great
enough. That's such a good way of putting it as well. For people who are listening to this thinking, right, I am going to be having an induction at whatever, or I have been told I am, thinking it's literally step on the conveyor belt and get taken through and there's a baby at the end of it.
Yeah.
That you can skip steps. You get to choose these steps that you take.
Yeah.
Step one. And obviously going through these steps and we're only doing this really briefly. You don't have to have all of these steps. You might not want certain ones, you might skip them out. So step one, I would say, would be a sweep, which might surprise some people listening to this. But
including many healthcare professionals who would
say it's a more natural form of induction.
Oh, it's natural,
absolutely natural, because people poke me in the vagina all the time.
All the time.
A sweep. My brain's anyway. So a sweep is ultimately, it's not a chemical hormone. Yes, it's not a mechanical, it's not an object inserted into you, but it is somebody trying to stimulate your labour when it otherwise wouldn't have happened at that exact point.
No. And ultimately, with something like a sweep, it's because it is inserting your fingers into your cervix to irritate it, to try and promote hormonal response.
Yeah.
And change slightly position of baby to put more pressure on it, things like that. It's not, if those hormones aren't ready, those sorts of things aren't effective. So we already, people use that as we're going to do this to prevent you having an induction, and it will work, it'll be really effective, get baby going, da 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 da. But as we will go on and you'll see, with all stages of induction, if your body isn't ready and susceptible to receiving these sorts of interventions, inductions of labour aren't, might not work.
So I think definitely having an understanding that a sweep is still a form of induction. It is a valid choice, as are all of these steps, but it is the first step. But if you were to be booked in for an induction, you would already have been offered sweeps. So you don't have to go into an induction ward in order to have a sweep. That can be offered in your normal community midwife appointments.
At home.
even at a home setting. So the induction process, we have booked you in for an induction at however many weeks, that's sweeps aren't really considered in any of that. You've probably been offered some of those separately anyway.
Yeah.
So the next step on that ladder would be ripen, I hate this phrase, ripening your cervix. It's up there with moist in terms of cringy words for me. Ripening.
Hey, well, when I hear ripen the cervix, what I imagine I imagine it and go, I can't imagine this, but somebody going into a fruit tree and trying to ripen the fruit, like, you can't, like, obviously, it doesn't, yeah. Anyway, that's...
No, you're absolutely right. That's a really good thing to think about it in this induction one is... that you can't make a fruit get ripe. Like, you could put green tomatoes on a windowsill and you could, you know, take things out of the fridge and stuff. But ultimately, strawberries on a plant don't ripen because you go and do anything to them.
Yeah.
And so ripening of the cervix is basically readying the cervix and helping to prepare the cervix for then the next kind of positive feedback loops that happen hormonally. Cervix will ripen spontaneously in a spontaneous labor without you knowing about it. So these procedures are in order to encourage that ripening to happen. They can happen in two ways, chemical or mechanical. Do you, Leanne, have much mechanical ripening happening in Leicester, in your, around your trust? Because I know we don't generally have a lot of it.
A balloon catheter.
Apart from the balloon, yeah.
Yes, no. We have balloon catheter or the ProPess, pretty much, which is the pessary.
Okay, so do you want to explain the chemical side of ripening?
Yeah, so it can happen in different forms. So yeah, ProPess is a pessary. You can use a gel or you can use a balloon catheter. So they insert the pessary to the top of the cervix to try and encourage the prostaglandins to, and obviously the gel will include some synthetic prostaglandin to try and stimulate the cervix to shorten, to thin, to soften, dilate, all of those things, ready to for the next stage of labor or induction. So something like a gel would be inserted using fingers and swiped around the top of the cervix. Cervical lining at the top of the neck of the cervix, I suppose, the ProPess is again inserted into the cervix in the same way, placed at the top, and it kind of absorbs into that cervical lining the fake hormones, and then a balloon will sit on top, and then sometimes that doesn't have chemicals in it, sometimes that is just a mechanical tool, so that would be put inserted in, and when the cervix is like stretched, basically, it can take a good few times with it if it's not a hormonal balloon. It will fall out basically once this cervix has got to its desired level, where the balloon is no longer supported by the cervix, so it would fall out.
So basically, it's like a
little
tube with a deflated balloon that's inserted through your cervix to the other side where baby is. That's then inflated with water normally.
Water, yeah.
To artificially represent the head of a baby
pressing
down on the cervix from the inside in order to simulate basically the pressure of a head and therefore the feedback mechanisms and the hormone release that that would generate.
Yeah.
And then the way it looks when it's inflated reminds me of, you know, when you have a balloon model dog, and they've got the little bit of balloon after the tail, and if you suck on it, you get the little pom-pom bit on the end.
Yeah.
Looks exactly like that.
And it's weird, you know, because one of the things I get confused about with the balloon catheter pessary is because you're placing it and it's not massive, but it's not, it's trying to replicate the baby's head on the cervix. Yeah, that means the baby's head can't be on the cervix. So it's a real
it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, we're going to do this to try and encourage this, but then actually you're not enabling the body to do what it needs to do. So then actually that can have a knock-on negative effect. I just find that quite interesting that that's a solution that's now been used.
Yeah, in my experience, certainly, if you have not had a previous cesarean, it is way less likely that you would ever be offered a mechanical form of ripening like the Foley balloon.
Yeah.
If you are planning a VBAC, so vaginal birth after cesarean, it's known that any hormone chemical for any chemical process is going to potentially risk hyperstimulation of the uterus, which would increase risks for a VBAC, whereas a mechanical method has less risk of that. So that's generally where I've experienced the balloon catheter being used, is when the person is a VBAC.
I agree. And also maternal requests. I have had someone who has had a previous negative experience with, she didn't end up having it actually, but previous negative experience with a chemical pessary. So said if I was going to have it again, it'd have to be the balloon, otherwise, otherwise I'd refuse. She didn't end up needing it, but that would put in place so that they could.
And that's another reminder that we're going to talk about why you might be offered an induction in a minute, but ultimately your request, you choosing something, is one of, if not the top most valid reasons for having any of this stuff, you requesting it. And if you are being offered a particular type of induction on that ladder and you actually would like to discuss having an alternative, then always have that conversation.
Yeah.
So if your cervix is ripened, I can't say it in the normal voice, I just can't. And if it's ripening, then what we're expecting then is the cervix has opened enough that access might be possible. And if it hasn't worked, I'm doing little speech marks there, if it's not worked, or labour isn't progressing as desired by you or your healthcare provider, although that yardstick might be slightly different, then if access is available, then the next step would be, it would be in notes, AROM, artificial rupture of membranes, basically someone breaking your waters.
Yeah.
This always, when I describe it, does make people cringe, but that would be done via vaginal examination. I'm doing this with my fingers, and this is just audio. Basically, if you imagine a crochet hook, a really long crochet hook, that's being held, pointing the sharp hook, pointing inwards to the fingers, but those fingers are inserted, so the hook isn't facing the outside, the vagina wall. Once the fingers have gone through your cervix, they will then extend the little crochet hook end a little bit further in, and they'll kind of hook the bag of waters, hopefully, breaking the waters and releasing the waters. So that's the next step.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, if that doesn't work or something else is deemed to be required, then the next step would be, again, very much chemical, and it would be a hormone drip, usually referred to as Syntocinon, or Pitocin is the name that would be used in America and in other countries. So if you ever hear reference, if you're following accounts and you hear reference to Pitocin, that's a synthetic hormone for induction, the same as Syntocinon would be.
Yeah. And I think
explain a bit more about
what that is,
how the hormone drip works.
Yeah, so basically, Syntocinon is a synthetic form of oxytocin, and oxytocin is our hormone that basically causes contractions. So we have receptors in our uterus that are woken throughout pregnancy, and then we get to this hormonal balance, physiological balance when we go into labor, and those receptors are stimulated and we go into spontaneous labor. With syntocinon, it is synthetic. So it is a form of oxytocin, which they created artificially, which have similar properties in the way that it can irritate the receptors to contract the uterus, but it's done forcibly and doesn't have the same hormonal benefits that our oxytocin has in our bodies that we produce. So what it does, it basically forces our uterus to contract to try and draw the cervix up, increasing our fundus and able to push our baby out. So it can be really effective at basically, well, it is really effective at forcing contractions, but instead of having this really lovely slow start to labor, having those little breaks between contractions, letting them build in intensity, they are completely regular every 2 to 3 minutes, and they are intense from the word go. So I've never experienced it, thankfully. I say thankfully because all the conversations I hear around it have always like, oh my god, it went from 0 to 100, and it was so intense, I wasn't prepared for it. And yeah, it is an intense environment to be in, both physically because you're in hospital, but also because how it works. So as that then continues, they would slowly increase the intensity. So you increase the power.
Increase the dose.
Yeah, the dose goes up basically. And it will get to around 10, 12 at the max, from my experience, which is the dose that they give you, which is recorded on the machine. Obviously, this is going in through a cannula in your hand, by the way. So it's intravenous, goes in. So you have to have a cannula to have this. It's just very intense forms of contractions that aren't spontaneous, aren't natural. So it does feel very different.
Yeah. I think we're purposefully not going to go into each type in, because we will do that at some point. But it's worth knowing that each type, each bit of process, so whether it's pessary, whether it's artificial breaking of waters, whether it's a Foley balloon or the drip, whatever, all of those things bring with them different needs, different risks, different benefits. They will influence your birth in different ways in terms of where you can then choose to birth, different, all of that sort of stuff. But if we talk about what's probably close to our hearts in terms of induction, which is why someone might be offered one, because as we know, the vast majority of people who are pregnant will have this discussed with them at some point, especially if you include sweeps in that.
Everybody. Yeah, I mean, I'd like to say even home birth teams don't necessarily do it, but they do.
They will mention it. They will offer it.
Because they have to. That's with my list. Every single person will be offered one. It usually starts at around 38, 39 weeks. Home birth, they're a bit better and they will offer it a little bit later from experience, usually at 40 weeks. Yeah. I generally offer it 41 weeks, especially with guidelines changing and things like that.
People are offered induction for all manner of different reasons. So I think we could talk about each one in so much detail, but just go through them, and then people listening, you might find that you fit into this. It makes loads of sense because you are that category or a combination of those categories. So let's see if we can manage to think of all of the possibilities.
All of
them. I'm going to go straight away in with gestation.
Yeah.
So you'll be offered an induction if you are deemed to be a sufficiently high gestation that you are deemed it is no longer safe for you to keep continuing with your pregnancy. So for the vast majority of people without any other risk factors, that will be when you reach 41 weeks. It might be, well, you'll have had it talked about well before then. It used to be that people were offered induction to have had the baby by 42 weeks.
Yeah.
Since guidelines changing now, people offer induction in order to have the baby by 41 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Gestation of pregnancy, reason number one. Your turn.
And that's for everyone, isn't it? That's the thing. I think we're saying that first, because everybody will. It doesn't matter. Risk factors.
No other risk factors necessary.
No. Another reason for induction would, from me, age. Age, what, how old you are. So you hit
I'm
that.
Old. I'm very old. So if I...
magic number. Hit the magic number, mate. 40. Ding, 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 ding.
42. I'm 42. You said, right. But then in our... I've known of people, it's the age at which induction is offered for age has continued to change.
Yes.
It used to be around 35.
Mm-hmm.
That is now generally when it comes to the high at-risk demographic groups, generally 35 tends to be a borderline. Like if somebody comes to me and they're 35, 36, I'm going to be saying you may be hearing talk about your age being a factor. Yeah. But you're 37, 38, approaching 40, it's a no-brainer. Your age will absolutely be a factor leading to induction being offered. Definitely. Yeah,
100%.
Size of your baby or perceived size of your baby. If you are deemed to be having a baby that is small, if you are deemed to be having a baby that is massive, if you've had fundal measurements where there's been a shift, if there's been scan measurements, if the fundal measurement's been shown some kind of concern, then you'd be referred for a growth scan. But whatever the observation tool is, you will be offered an induction early if your baby is small, because they want to make sure that the baby's healthy. So we want to get the baby out as soon as possible. Or if your baby is big, because, oh my goodness, what if you cannot birth your baby because they're just so massive? I feel like I just need to shut up now.
Another one would be size of the parent. So your BMI, that is always a big one, isn't it?
Oh, that's... I mean, that, highly accurate.
Highly accurate BMI. Yeah, so again, if you have a BMI usually of over 35.
30.
Yeah. Or is it 30? 30. 30 would be, again, trust. This is saying this is the problem. It's all trust dependent. If it's over 35, wow, you are definitely being induced by their guidelines.
Yeah.
But yeah, so over 30 in some trusts, over 35, pretty much definite. It just means you can't physically, because you're so big, you cannot birth your baby. Like, how the hell do you even live anymore, apparently?
And we can and probably will do an entire podcast episode on just BMI and pregnancy and birth. But yeah,
100%.
BMI. The next one, and this is what really, really surprises people, your race, the colour of your skin. And you might well be asking, what the hell has that got to do with risk factors that would require me to have an induction? It's a very good question. In a nutshell, the mortality rates for Black and brown women and their babies is significantly higher than those for white women. Those for Asian descent are far greater than for people who have white racial origin as well, but not as high as for Black and brown women. And the reaction, the response, the solution to that appears to be to induce those babies early to avoid those negative outcomes.
Because it's clearly a problem with them.
It's not at all systemic racism.
Absolutely
all.
Not.
No way.
I can't sense the massive sarcasm in our tones at that point. Then I just want to reiterate that it is...
We're not this podcast for you.
Yeah, it is absolutely systemic racism there.
You might remind me what year it was. May 21 was the feedback call out for the new induction guidelines. I want to say 21. It was COVID. Basically, the NICE guidelines were being updated for induction. And what really, really caused a fire among birth workers is that certain at-risk groups were highlighted as to be induced at 39 weeks across the board for Black and brown women or birthing people, people with a BMI of over 30, people who are 35 or over age-wise, and then the one we haven't mentioned is anybody who's had assisted fertility or IVF, which then massively disproportionately affects LGBT families who are more likely to be using fertility assistance. Thankfully, once the new guidelines came in the October, there were some changes. to the recommendations, but it still basically said these are at-risk groups and it should be discussed, it should be offered, and so on and so forth. So it's a big bone of contention for us as birth workers because of the absence of evidence for this. But yeah, so I've brought in another one there, assisted fertility. So we've got gestation, size of baby, age, race, BMI, IVF.
So I think there's another couple that I would usually add in, which often come in towards later on in pregnancy, would be gestational diabetes and preeclampsia as to other. I mean, I would say they, particularly preeclampsia, there's often good evidence to use for induction of labour to be used in those circumstances, depending on this, on the, obviously the individual and things like that.
Yeah.
But again, there's a blanket policy for gestational diabetes. If you have gestational diabetes, then induction is right for you. When in fact, actually, if it's well managed with diet alone, it's not an indicator that induction of is necessary, especially at that 39 week that they want to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I would say, once we're starting to talk about medical conditions, that now starts to become reasons for being offered induction that I think we would both agree, and other birth workers would agree, were more evidence-based, clinical reasons for induction being necessary is probably not the right word, but certainly
could be
a clinical reason for induction. Basically, when the pregnant person has got a condition where having the pregnancy ended so that that condition can be reduced, can be eased, symptoms can be targeted with medication, whatever.
Yeah,
that's beneficial in not all but many cases. I would put cholestasis in there as well, as another pregnancy related condition, where symptoms are such that it's impacting on the birthing person, the pregnant person, and therefore inducing the baby in order that the symptoms would then reduce, because the symptoms are associated with the pregnancy itself.
Agreed. And I think that's it. It's about knowing, and this is what we're going to come on to next, is understanding not only the benefits and risks of the induction processes, but also the benefits and risks of accepting the induction based on the reasons that you are being, that are being proposed to you as to why you might or might not need it. And that's, for me, as somebody who supports pregnant folk, it's so important that you have this information to know that actually, sometimes just because I fall under a category doesn't mean to say that that is the right thing for me. It might well be, but knowing that it might not be, and you've got a chance to have that discussion and make your choice, that's really, really important. And that's one of the biggest takeaways I want people to get from this podcast episode, is that the choice is theirs, and it's not that they have to decline it as their choice, it's that they need to know that the choice they're making is appropriate and accurate for them.
Yeah, absolutely. That it's not a case of everyone with a BMI of X must follow this path. Everyone who's had IVF must follow this path. And also, I would say the evidence you've been given, question it.
Yeah.
So, for example, IVF pregnancies are generally told that they will need to be need to consent to an induction at a particular gestation based on a certain set of evidence. And actually, when you really look at that set of evidence that they're likely to refer to, it is not appropriate. It is not relevant to probably any of you, because the data refers to poor outcomes at far earlier gestations, I think pre-28 weeks.
Yeah, some of the research that I've been looking at for a client at the moment, it's all around pre-24 weeks.
Pre-24 weeks. So therefore, it's the stats around induction being of benefit in, or rather in, reduced stillbirth rate, which is usually what all this comes down to, refers to gestations that are way weeks and weeks before you've even got to. Then it's actually, is it even relevant for you right now?
In Denmark, which I know is the one that they often refer to, and it's overwhelming, like the evidence, but they haven't, that particular study have not disclosed when the stillbirth rates actually happened. And it didn't just look at IVF, it looked at lots of different things around stillbirth, and they didn't disclose it. But when you look into it deeply, as with all of them, they are predominantly pre 28, 24 weeks.
Yeah.
And the other thing with IVF, you will be, even if it's not an induction, they will strongly recommend you have sweeps from around, regular sweeps from 38 weeks. Mm-hmm. Again, no evidence around that whatsoever, is there? Yeah.
So if we were to say, you know, what is your legal obligation? Like, what circumstances are there that you would absolutely need to consent to an induction? And the answer is none of them. You could also specifically request an induction for whatever reason you have. It may or may not be supported. It would refer to as maternal request, but a birthing person's request to have an induction. And there's lots of reasons why somebody might request an induction, usually linked to problems with poor mental health towards the end of pregnancy, or linked to really poor mobility, physical discomfort around pelvic girdle pain, you know, really severe pelvic girdle pain and so on and so forth. I know I was an induced baby because when I was born, when my mum was pregnant with me, my father worked at sea. He wasn't around anymore. She would be on her own. So I was induced because it was more convenient because she found childcare for my brother.
Yep.
But ultimately, there are circumstances under which you are able to say, can I please be induced? The healthcare providers should counsel you through that, as in explain the risks and benefits to you, just if it isn't actually appropriate, if maybe you aren't aware of the risks that might be associated with. But this is choice, like this is all about choice.
Yeah. And it is maternal choice is, it should always be the top of that hierarchy, in my opinion.
Yeah. And none of this episode, none of any information anybody gives you about induction matters, as in when it comes to what your decision is. It really doesn't matter what you think anybody else would think. Nobody should be making a judgment on your decision. I don't give a shit whether you have an induction or not, as long as you feel it is the right thing for you and you're supported at every step of the way. Like, yeah, that's it.
As long as there's always that kind of weird moment where you kind of go, well, as long as you are informed, so you can give like correct consent, so forth. It's a weird one for me, because part of me thinks like you get to make the decision regardless of whether you're informed or not. However, when it comes to something like induction, because so much of it is unnecessary, I do believe mm-hmm. there should be a good level of being informed to make that choice. Yeah. Purely because of the outcomes can be quite intense. I'm not saying the outcomes negatively in terms of for you or the baby, but it does often.
But there are risks. There are a significant number of risks.
Yeah, and I think therefore, if you don't know that, then that decision is quite flawed, because you're then going to go through a process where you didn't know the outcomes could be X, Y, Z, and that could be quite much more detrimental to your mental health or your physical health than you realize. And therefore, you should have known that information before. However, as we've said, your choice matters, your voice matters, and your birth matters. So however you want that to be, that's the priority.
By saying about the voice, I think I don't know if this even exists, but if you were to look at stats around reasons for inductions, pure maternal request or birthing person request would be minuscule.
Yeah.
Passing 100%, not offered from anybody else, pure at the request. And if you look at all the others, realistically, was there clinical need? And I don't mean based on clinical opinion. I don't mean based on evidence that is significantly flawed. Clinical need, and that's where I think we come to now, is what the stats for induction are now versus what they used to be, versus what the World Health Organization says they should be.
Which is between 10 to 15% of births, based on the World Health Organization, should be induced. And that is because they're looking at that sort of figure would indicate there's some sort of clinical need for that pregnancy to be ended.
So ultimately, that reflects that we would expect that 10 to 15% of labours or pregnancies have a clinical need for which induction may be of benefit.
Yes.
Okay. So if it's 10 to 15%, and obviously this that that is a range, and that's going to differ depending on the area of the world you're living in, let alone different circumstances. But 10 to 15% of pregnancies, there is a clinical need where induction may be of benefit to that person or the baby.
Yep.
What's the induction rate for your trust?
I'm on the MMVP, so I get to see some of these stats, and we're forcing them to share them. But the ones that I have most recent, it was 36.9% induction rate.
With our trust, getting the information is like getting blood from a stone.
That varies as well. Like, I, 1 month it was 39%.
37 here.
Yeah, it varies, but apparently it's they're happy with that being the rate of induction because it's in line with other trusts locally,
which is an insane acceptance level to have. Is it's okay because it's almost like a county saying we don't mind our murder rates being this high or our robbery rates being this high because our next door county have the same rate. Like, is that what? Yeah. So the most recent study, and I'm quoting this from Sarah Wickham, who will talk about information at the end, but Sarah Wickham has done a little discussion post about a very recent set of data, 2024, Taylor et al, 2024.
Yeah.
And it was a report of cross-sectional survey of maternity units in the UK. And it was from specialist obstetricians working at 54 maternity units. So it covered 35% of the units in the UK. And the induction rates varied from 19.2% to 53.4%. So it didn't even touch the World Health Organization recommendations. And okay. I would, like, show me the trust that's got 19.2%. I quite know where that is.
Look at Kemi, who shares the trust's statistics very frequently.
Yeah,
I've not seen an induction rate
below 35.
Below 35 and anything. She shares them from all over the country. So yeah, I'd love to know where that 19%
was. But saying that they varied up to 53.4%, where the World Health Organization deems that only up to 15% of pregnancies would have a clinical need for an induction potentially being beneficial.
Yep.
Some trusts are inducing 53.4% of labours.
Half of women in that area,
over half,
cannot apparently start labour on their own.
And there is no way that 53.4% of pregnancies have a clinical evidence-based need to have that pregnancy induced. Ultimately, this all does come back to choice.
Yeah.
But like you said, the implications of an induced labour and birth, and there are incredibly positive inductions.
Yeah.
There are also inductions that lead to a cascade of intervention that create huge amounts of risks for you, your birth, and your baby.
Yeah.
Or, heaven forbid, all three. And so this figure, all these figures, suddenly become incredibly irresponsible and quite dangerous if there is a clinical need for that induction process. And if we're not really looking at the nuance around individual people rather than a blanket IVF, race, BMI, whatever. So I think we should probably look at benefits and risks.
Yeah. I will do
because otherwise we could debate on these stats
for ages,
forever.
I mean,
and it's important that we inform as much as we can. So
we do struggle at bringing up the benefits, let's be honest. Like, we have had this conversation. It's quite difficult to drum up a lot of benefits.
And that's probably probably a little bit unfair, actually. We should probably hold our hands up that.
Yeah.
There will be everybody's reasons are really personal. Everybody's risk like acceptance of risk is really different. What I find risky, Leanne wouldn't find risky, and vice versa. And it's the same with birth. It's the same, you know, fact is people have you ever done a bungee jump, Leanne?
No, I've jumped out of a plane though.
Okay, so right, I've done 9 bungee jumps, including one of the highest in the world at the time. I still wouldn't jump out of a plane. And you may never do a bungee jump, right? It's weird. We all have totally different aversions and draws to risky situations, and birth is the same. So personal benefits will vary, but I think personal circumstances, how you're feeling, your mindset, your mental state at the time is really significant and should be really highly valued as a contributing factor and a benefit as for that person.
Yeah. And I think another benefit that I think comes up is, as we said before, if there's a medical condition where ending the pregnancy would be best for all outcomes, then that is a benefit of induction. And another one that I think is something that we need to consider is that when we talk about the risks of it, it'll often go, well, we might as well have a cesarean then, I'm no point going for an induction. But there are benefits of vaginal birth that outweigh the risks of a cesarean birth. So even though the induction might not be as positive in some areas, there's benefits of vaginal birth that an induction would hopefully, if it was at the right time, would enable us to gain. So for so a benefit of induction would be that it does try, whether it's effective or not, but it does try to promote a vaginal birth. So the baby has the benefit and you have the benefit of that.
Definitely. And like you said, that's the vast majority of people who are opting for an induction. Hopefully they are aware that a cesarean is also a valid choice at that point. And we should emphasize that if you want to decline an induction, you are able to skip that step and request a cesarean if that's your choice. But for so many people, they want to go through an attempt of an induction because they ultimately want all the benefits, like you said, of the vaginal birth. And that's not just somebody wanting a vaginal birth. We're talking about benefits for the baby's immune system. We're talking about, recovery. There's all sorts of different reasons. And it isn't just, but I want a normal birth. It's not about that. It's more personal than that.
Can you think of any of the benefits because they're the only ones that in my head come forward right now?
Well, I guess that the fact is that there will be evidence to show that there are increased negative outcomes for certain circumstances, and therefore for somebody they might feel that however small that risk is. And being really honest, a lot of the increases in stillbirth rate or negative outcomes for some of these circumstances, like race or BMI or various different circumstances or characteristics, if that however tiny increase in risk of stillbirth, if that is significant enough for somebody, then that's the benefit. It is important that we understand the absolute risk rather than just 10 times double, twice as many, whatever. Yeah. But if they have an absolute set of data and that risk still feels too big, then there's your benefit.
Yeah, the benefit of the induction is it tries to minimise that risk regardless of how small it might be.
Yeah, because if for an individual that risk is not, if they're not willing to take that risk, then that's really important that that's honoured for somebody.
Yeah.
But I think in the absence of clinical need, the risks of induction significantly outweigh any benefit.
Agreed. And the risks are pretty vast as well, aren't they?
And I think what we should consider here when we think about the risks of induction are the cascade that can come from it. We know that induction increases your risk of cesarean.
Yep.
So if we opt for an induction, we need to acknowledge that we are already increasing our risk of cesarean. And if we are going to go through an induction process, we take on board then those layers of risk. It isn't just a case of, there's risks for a sweep. But let's say if you end up having a drip, you have possibly already had a sweep with its own set of risks. You may then have had a pessary with its own set of risks. You then have maybe your water's broken. And if you then end up requiring a cesarean as well, you have all of those layered on risks. So suddenly the risk of that process has become significantly higher because of the succession of additional processes.
Yeah, agreed. And I think that's why lots of people do often, if they're at that point, opt for a cesarean prior to those things often because of those layers of risk. They seem to far more daunting than the risk of cesarean in the first place. So,
but you said earlier, and to be fair, full disclosure, we've tried recording this about four times. So I don't know whether it was in this recording or one of the previous ones. But you mentioned about skipping steps, and that's where it's not a case of you have to decide induction or cesarean and that's the end of it. Is you could start induction process and step off.
Yeah.
And you know, you opting for a cesarean, that's not taken away from you if you consent to the other thing.
It's missing a ring off the ladder, isn't it?
Yeah. And that is that choice, isn't it? You saying you want this episode to be all about emphasis of choice, and it's that choice continues throughout any process. No choices are taken away from you because you've consented to a particular procedure.
I think the thing that I want to kind of flag here a little bit as well in terms of like the risks of induction is, as we've said, like risks are things like you've discussed cesarean, but obviously one of the things that often lead to that risk is things like increased risk of like anaesthetic use, and therefore that reduction in mobility. And then that reduces like space in the pelvis, and so that spiral that leads on to that risk of cesarean.
And I think that's worth saying, that anaesthetic use, that quite commonly, particularly once you've reached the step of the ladder for a cannula and that hormone drip of Syntocin or Pitocin, because of the intensity that those contractions can develop, the speed at which they could develop, and the fact is, it's nothing about your ability to cope with labor that it does not come into this, that you a really interesting, a lovely lady who I was doula for, but she's also a doula herself, Bryony Aston, she did a post a while ago that basically said she loved one of the affirmations that was around these contractions aren't bigger than me because they are me. But she made this really specific emphasis. This is not an affirmation for induced labor because they are bigger than you. That spontaneous physiological birth isn't bigger than you. It's all natural. It's your body doing something it's all designed to do at intensities it's designed for.
Yeah.
Induced labor, chemically, it is not normal. And the synthetic oxytocin, chemically, is considered the same, but it's
not.
Natural oxytocin crosses your blood-brain barrier. So natural oxytocin stimulates contractions, but it also gets into your brain and does wonderful, I always say it's magic, it does wonderful things to your brain.
Yep.
Increases other hormone release, things like endorphins, it creates natural relaxation, natural pain relief, and so on and so forth. That synthetic oxytocin does not cross the blood-brain barrier, so it has the intense contraction effects, but it does not give you all the supportive relaxant pain relief off in labor land,
which is something that we need to, I think, which follows on nicely, not nicely, that's the wrong phrasing, but induction, one of the risks are increased postnatal depression. And one of the reasons is because of that lack of blood-brain barrier. And also, I was reading, I can't remember where I've read it now, but it was talking about that, and obviously not the lack of the release of endorphins and things, but also that fear of that feeling of failure, and negative birth outcomes. Is in that, I don't mean again risk like stillbirth or anything like that, but negative birth outcomes because of that perceived failure on them, that they've not been able to do it.
They couldn't cope, or
couldn't cope, and those sorts of things that then led to that postnatal feeling, and then that escalates to that depression. And it is a risk. There is a clear, again, if you look at statistics, so one in three women will have some sort of birth trauma, and one in five will have postnatal depression, is the most recent statistics on the PANDAS website. And if you look at those, if you then break down the studies into those, lots of those are linked to birth, have some sort of intervention, whether that's induction or not, but some form of intervention that has then led to those feelings. And to me, that's got to be raised as one of the risks.
And something that's come out of that 2024 study is around... people were asked, specialist obstetricians were asked about various things linked to induction. It's really interesting. about, well, in fact, we'll try and link it from to this podcast. It's around problems associated with induction. So data around whether there's delays or whether there's people are getting the right information prior. So one in five units reports delays in hospital admission for induction, often or always. So one in five state that there's delays often or always. And we will know of plenty of people who we've supported who have been offered induction with some form of scary reason. You are putting your baby at risk. Stillbirth rate is going up. We need to get your baby out now. And then suddenly there isn't a bed for them, so they can't go and be induced for 2 days anyway. Which for us supports what we may be saying of this may not be necessary. But for that person, if you've just told them their baby may die prematurely because they if they don't get induced, and you're now sending them home for 2 days.
That mental health is not doing well, is it?
So delays, but then also another third of units reporting delays sometimes. So in total, you're talking about a significant proportion of units reporting that there are delays in inductions. And heaven forbid that might be because their induction rates are nearing 50%.
Do the math.
And then also an important source of delays, moving women from antenatal ward to delivery suite, but also information around are people getting the guidance and the information about why they're being induced, what the process is like. I know people who've come onto my courses, and you will absolutely have the same thing. You've had a previous induction come onto your course when you talk about induction, and they tell you that they didn't know any of this.
Yep. Every single time.
And this is not to say that our courses are utterly perfect, though obviously they are very close. The information people are given is just not okay. It's just not adequate. It's just absolutely inadequate.
Completely. And when I'm, like I said, I'm on the Maternity Voices Partnership group, and we're looking at updating it, and we keep on getting drafts of it, the documents. And I'm like, no, that's inaccurate. No, that's inaccurate. No, you've not described that properly. And I'm thinking, this is coming from clinicians.
But it's also, that's where the language is just completely, it's not relevant. People can't understand the language. So immediately it feels scary. Yeah,
and it's literally, and it's inaccurate. Like some of the things, like this syntocinal drip is a form of oxytocin. It is not more painful. No, that's a full-blown lie. Like you can't put that in literature that you're giving out.
I'm assuming that obstetrician has been given the syntocinal drip and experienced it
fully. Really, but again, this is where finding information that's external from the system is really beneficial.
Oh, do you know what? We are so smooth with our segues.
Oh my God, yeah.
Oh! Oiled to perfection. Probably with a lovely aromatherapy oil from Take 5.
Always. We'll have to tag it.
So if somebody wanted to get spot, like we're literally on this video section of our, we're on a podcast, we're on videos. We're both clutching all these induction books with us. Now, not your average person is probably going to want to use this as bedtime reading. However, if somebody wanted to read more about induction, what are your book recos, Leanne?
My favorite, and I think it is probably the most accessible for the general public, is In Your Own Time by Sarah Wickham.
I was just holding mine up because I was going to predict like one mind.
Honestly, it is.
It's also the one of the most recent as well. It was a COVID thing, wasn't it? 2021.
And yeah, the front it says how Western medicine controls the start of labor and why this needs to stop. It is all evidence based. Sarah Wickham, follow her on Instagram. She is just a fountain, a wealth of knowledge. Everything she shares is evidence based.
It's also readable.
So easy to read. I love reading her books. Like genuinely.
Also go on if you don't feel you can access the books, whether that's you don't want to buy a book, you won't read the whole book, you don't want to spend the money on the book. If you go to sarahwickham.com, so it's Sarah spelled S-A-R-A and then Wickham, W-Y-C-K-H-A-M, you'll find so many blogs and reflection pieces. And if you go in, there's a little search this site box and put in induction, there'll be so much stuff that's relevant. The other one that I would add to that is Inducing Labour, Making Informed Decisions, which was kind of the precursor to the In Your Own Time book. It's also by Sarah Wickham. And what is pretty comparable, if not effectively the same content, because I think it was also written by Sarah Wickham, is the Ames. Oh, no, I'm lying. The principal author for the Ames one is Nadia Higson. Okay. Why did I always think Sarah Wickham was in that? So, Inducing Labour, Making Informed Decisions by Sarah Wickham, but also the Ames Guide, so A-I-M-S, and they are independent from the NHS system. So it's got unbiased information. It's just called the Guide to Induction of Labour. And that's really good for things like data sets. So if somebody's being offered an induction, a client messages me and says, I'm being offered induction because my baby's been is too small, I will simply go to the section on induction of labour for suspected small babies and I'll photograph the pages and send it to them.
Yeah, I do the same. There's another couple of online resources that I would send you to, which would be Evidence-Based Birth and Midwife Thinking, because both of those have really good, again, blog posts, article posts, which are really just smaller, easy to digest, still evidence-based. And then my other kind of author, and I mean, it is my Midwife Thinking anyway, but Dr. Rachel Reed is my other go-to. She's got a book as well, which is in the Pinter and Martin section, and it's called Why Induction Matters. But it's a really small pocket-sized book, and it's it is easy to access, easy to read. And it's got little examples of women, predominantly women, who have experienced induction and their little little blurbs about their experiences. So again, it's easy for you to kind of, I don't know.
Pick in and out of and...
Yeah, and just pick things out, and cause it's like got some anecdotal points to it. It helps you understand things. So I think that book is really good. And what I love about Dr. Rachel Reed is she, again, is evidence-based, and her work is so centered around physiology that for her to write a book about induction, you know that it's really well thought of. So strongly recommend that book as well.
And none of these books have an undertone of reasons why you should absolutely never ever be induced.
No. This book at the end, there's a chapter all around how to create a birth plan for a medical induction. So again, it's actually
really practical.
Really practical, yeah.
Yeah. I think to finish up, we like to do a bit of top tips. Mm-hmm. Would be if you are being offered induction, whether you are 8 weeks or 38 weeks and anywhere in between, find out, listen to the podcast we've done previously. I think it's episode 8 about preparing for appointments, because this kind of similar to that.
Yep.
Find out why you are being offered induction. And I don't mean age. I mean, why?
Yep.
Why does your age mean an earlier birth is recommended? Dig into it. Yeah, but why?
Yeah.
So no, rather than just, you know, if you're meet up with your friends and you say, yeah, well, actually, I've got to be induced at this many weeks. Know why that is the case.
Yeah.
That is so important. And if you don't know why, find out as much as you can so you understand, is that what you want in the first place? If it is, brilliant, but know why.
Yeah.
What would your top tip be?
If you then agree to it or accept it, and you've done your research, all that is plan for it. I think we'll probably need to do an episode centered around that, but actually make a plan that really centers you in that induction. Yeah. So again, knowing that you can accept and decline things, how are you going to keep control in certain environments? What's the best ways for you to create an environment that supports you and your physiology to help the induction process? So I think that would be my, I know it's not a top tip from this, but I think that's something we need to do.
Definitely.
That would be mine.
And I think it's just saying what we said about this, the vast majority of people are going to face this question.
Yeah.
I think planning for an induction is a really sensible thing for
plan for a cesarean. If you're not, if it's something changes in that pregnancy, you've got that in your back pocket to go, I've already thought about this. And it puts you on the front foot every time.
I would say another one would be know what to expect. Not just know what a pessary looks like or what it even is, know what to expect from a pessary. Like, do you have a pessary put in and then suddenly you're in labour? Or I'm just being silly, really, but do you, you know, 12 hours later, is it perfectly feasible that you experience no changes whatsoever and the pessary is taken out and another one put in? The answer to that is yes. But did you know that? Yep. So that, you know, people think I'm going to be induced tomorrow and think they're going to have a baby tomorrow. Some people will. I would say a significant number of people will have their baby on Sunday.
Yeah, yeah. 3 or 4 days.
know what to expect in reality. And then you're better to then go back to your tip to prepare how to manage that and how to support yourself with it.
Agreed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well,
we were very disciplined and efficient there, weren't we?
I would say so. I also feel that we have opened up a huge can of podcast worms. And we are going to have
podcast
to do
worms.
Podcast worms. And to do a lot more podcast episodes around this, because I think there's lots that we can explain in detail which will be helpful. But I do think this has will open those conversations for everybody, and they'll have a little good base point to go from to move forward.
And also, if listening to this has just actually created more questions for you, and I hope it has, then please feel free to pop onto mine or Leanne's social media and fire the questions at us. You don't have to be working with us or be a client of ours to ask us questions. And if we can't answer it there and then, if we haven't got the capacity to answer it there and then, what we can make do is just turn it into a podcast episode. So please don't sit there with questions and you not have anyone to ask them to. We're always here.
Absolutely. So on that note, I think we need to love you all and leave you all, because I think it's time for us to end.
Tears. Got kids to pick up from school.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you for listening, everyone.
Gosh, that was in sync, weren't it?
I'm Meg from Birth Evolution.
I'm Leanne from Birthhood, and we'll see you soon for another episode.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Do La La, the podcast.
With me, Leanne from Birthhood.
And me, Meg from Birth Evolution. It's been great to have you here with us as we chat about all things pregnancy, birth and postnatal.
We'd love to know what you think, so please do leave us a review. Follow both Meg and I on socials and share with your friends too. They'll be really glad you did.